Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. The saga of the Demoulas family and their Market Basket supermarket chain is the stuff of great drama. As the Boston Globe's Evan Horowitz writes, quote, it's complete with warring cousins, hand-to-hand combat, strife among prosperous citizens, and even a wayward son named Telemachus. And that synopsis doesn't include the protesting workers, the boycotting customers, and the two local musicians who've composed an anthem dedicated to Market Basket's cause. And by the way, they're going to be with us tomorrow in studio singing. Here with us in Studio 3 today for her take on this is Nancy Kane. As you know, Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey, folks.
So, Nancy, here's my question. I mean, we've been talking about this for days, and we want your perspective because you were over there at the Harvard Business School, and we've been saying we've never heard of anything like this in our lives. Are we right or are we wrong?
Well, yes. I mean, I honestly think Shakespeare putting together King Lear had nothing, right? The Demoulas family. So just, dear listeners, to take us back to the beginning of this fascinating saga, it starts in 1916 when two Greek immigrants, Arthur, that's anglicized or Americanized, and Ephronzini, a husband and wife couple, start a small grocery store in Lowell, Massachusetts. It's Greek-oriented, specializing in lamb. In 1954, so some 38 years later, they sell the chain to the two of their six children who want to buy a piece of it. I'm not sure it's a chain, but they sell the business to Telemachus, who's also known as Mike, and George Demoulas. Stay with me, dear reader. Those two brothers, Telemachus, known as Mike Demoulas, and George, spend the next 15 years ramping this thing into the modern age and creating a modern supermarket chain, you know, with what would begin to have the bearings or the marks of what we know of today as Demoulas Market Basket. In 1971, George, right, brother, now son of the founder, dies of a heart attack while on vacation in Greece, leaving Mike, or Telemachus, his brother, as the sole head of the business. In 1990, so that's 19 years later, heirs to George file suit in Massachusetts, that alleging that Mike had defrauded them of all but 8% of this private company's stock by diverting it into all kinds of shell companies. Okay, so now we got shell companies, so now we're moving into thriller land. In 1994, 4 years later, a judge named Maria Lopez rules that Mike had indeed, Telemachus Mike, had indeed defrauded George's family of almost $500 million.
And just to stop there for a second, yes, it is the very same Maria Lopez who you remember seeing on television yelling, sit down. That was her, but go ahead.
Okay, so you see, again, this story could not have been written better if you were a top screenplay writing team for Hollywood and big summer blockbuster movies. All right, so then she, the judge, awards George's family, remember, now we got Telemachus and George, now two warring factions like Reagan, Goneril, and Cordelia in Lear, only there's only two of them, 51% of the business. So control passes, right, to George's family. George, what we need to remember that Mike Telemachus has a son named Arthur T. Demoulas, right, who until recently was head of the company, and that George has a son named Arthur S. Demoulas. Okay, so that gets us now into the current generation. So, 1994, controlling interest in the business passes to George's side. Lots and lots of bad blood. You got to think about the Christmas celebrations in the family, right? And what it's like, the tension in the room. In 2003, Mike Telemachus dies. In 2006, Arthur, George's son, is rated the eighth wealthiest person in Boston by Boston Magazine with a net worth or an asset pool north of just about $1.6 million.
Billion or million?
Million. Billion. Billion, excuse me. A billion. Okay. So this is a nice chunk of change. In 2008, and this is where my timeline ends, Arthur T., this is Telemachus or Mike's son, is elected by the board. Private companies almost always have a governing board of directors that represents the private shareholders, just like a public company, only it's not a company regulated by the SEC. Arthur T. is elected by the board of directors as the president of the company. And that brings us now into the modern era. So Arthur T., right, allegedly and, you know, seemingly very much loved by his employees, a man who obviously followed the kind of management by, you know, walking around kind of strategy, very present in the stores, very customer and employee centered and and Fassel directs the company. And a famous quote I read in one of the many, many Boston Globe articles on this story a few days ago, a famous quote said, it's told the board several years ago, there is not one boss. There is not five bosses. There are not two bosses. There are not three bosses. There is one boss, and I'm it. So, you know, it sounds like he ruled with a lot of centralized authority. And then in the last 12 months, last 18 months, was actually brushed aside as the head of the company, and that's perhaps a very euphemistic way of saying it. And two outsiders, consultants is how I've seen them referred to. I don't know either of these people, so I can't comment on their backgrounds. Felicia Thornton and James Gooch are installed as co-CEOs. And that brings us about up to the summer of 2014, a summer, as I understand, firsthand and otherwise, of barren shelves, angry employees, lawsuits, because yes, dear listeners, there are lawsuits raging right now about how well DeMoulas under Arthur T., right, the beloved CEO, treated its employees, a summer of lawsuits, you know, emptying aisles and much, much unrest, as well as power to the people.
You know, speaking of power to the people, the thing, when you answered Marjorie's question, you're the historian at Harvard Business School, that you don't know of a similar situation where non-unionized workers, including many managers, have been willing to risk their livelihoods for a boss. There are a lot of bosses through the years who workers love and respect and say, I really want to work with them. But, let's just listen. Tom Traynor was in the studio the other day. There were two guys who'd worked for a combined 68 years at Market Basket. They both started at age 14. Traynor had been there 41 years. Listen to what Traynor has to say about Arthur T.
Is there any end game here short of the board of directors saying that Arthur T. DeMoulas is back in his position that would cause you guys to give up this fight here?
That is our only demand.
That is that
the only demand that he comes back with full authority. Short of that, it's non-negotiable.
And by the way, when you speak to any of these people, we've spoken a lot. I interviewed a guy the other night, 49 years he's been at the company. His two sons are there. As amazing as it is incredible to me that there has never been a time in recent history where workers, even at personal risk, have said, I love and respect this person so much and the way that he has treated me and the business in which I work that I'm willing to put myself out in line. I'm not criticizing other people for it. Yeah. How is it that this is such an aberration in American history?
It's not an aberration in sort of its broad outlines. I mean, there have been many beloved heads of companies, not as nearly as many as there probably were either toward which there was great indifference or in which there was anger. But a well-loved CEO is not a great outlier.
A well-loved CEO? No. I didn't say that. A well-loved CEO for whom you're willing to put your life
and career in line. Let me double-click on that piece because that's a really important piece, Jim. So, I can't think of another instance exactly like this. And I thought about it. I thought about it last night. I thought about it when Marjorie broached the question yesterday. I can't think of another instance where people, non-unionized, it's a little different when it's unionized and you have the organized power, right, of the coalition behind you, where non-unionized workers have said, we'll bow out of our jobs or risk our jobs in order to have someone at the helm that we really think is the right person and a good person. So I can't think of – so I think it's unusual because, one, workers put their jobs on the line very, very, very carefully. And this is putting something very important. There are families that have worked for DeMoulas, father, son, wife, daughter, putting their jobs on the line. That I think in itself is unusual. Secondly, they're doing it for a very indirect reason, right? These are not people who've necessarily had a cup of tea with Arthur T., right? Or had a cup of coffee or shared a beer or talked about the Red Sox. These are people who, by dint of the culture in the stores, by dint of the word on the grapevine, which is always the most important source of information in any organization, by dint of the folklore of the company, think this guy is a really, really critical piece of their lives. Critical enough that they'll walk off the job or protest. Eight have been fired, I believe, so far.
Mid-level managers.
As a result of protesting. Yeah. And P.S., what is just starting to emerge is the network of support that people willing to step out and protest are getting. They're organizing informal, very much like what we used to call benevolent societies in pre-industrial times, where workers organize in order to provide, like a strike fund, to provide funds for workers that are going out on the picket line and may lose their jobs. That is happening here too, dear listeners. So we have an amazing grassroots, you know, dynamism happening here about people willing to step up and say, it's, you know, I gotta, if I'm going to work here, I got to have Arthur T back. And lots of people that are willing to support them with money and other kinds of support systems in order to do that. It's really quite interesting. And we're not striking for, or we're not protesting for higher wages. We're not protesting for shorter
right,
hours.
Only indirect personal benefit.
Only indirect personal benefit that all these people believe.
Okay. That what?
Will come about as a result of Arthur T coming back to the tiller.
Okay, so you do these executive leadership things quite regularly. The next one you go to, the first hand that goes up says, Nancy Kane, I only want one thing out of this workshop, 2-day workshop. I want to know how I get my workers to feel about me like the market basket workers apparently feel about Arthur T. What's the answer? What do they do to create that level of loyalty to company, at least, you know, company under a certain leadership and to a certain leader? What do executives do? Isn't that everybody's goal?
So let me just start with a short list of you know, must-haves, necessary, not necessarily sufficient. First, you're visible in the stores. You're visible to what we call the frontline employees on a regular, right, non-fakey, right, credible way, in a regular, credible way. Secondly, right, you speak on a regular basis in different kinds of forums, but directly. And I'm not talking about just emails or little mission statements on the back of bathroom stall walls, right? You speak on a regular basis on the importance of individuals in your company. Third, you call them out. Like birthdays. I remember many years ago when a Starbucks barista donated a kidney to one of her customers who needed a kidney transplant. Howard Schultz like made sure no one didn't know that this woman in this Starbucks store, who was a regular customer, had given her a kidney transplant. Do you know how much loyalty that engendered from his workforce? Fourthly, right, you have a plan not only of decent compensation and benefits, right? Benefits, folks, not just money, right? And some kind of, you know, integrated strategy for why your people are essential and therefore your benefits are the best and wages are the best investment you ever make. You also have a career track for people. So it's interesting that, Jim, that you preface a lot of what you just said telling about people that have worked at Demoulas for years. Don't think that is incidental to people's sense of connection to Arthur T. Demoulas, whether, you know, he actually hired them. He probably didn't, right, 25 or 40 years ago. So that's a piece. People have to believe that their future is tied up with the company. That is simply not true at huge numbers of public companies today.
You know, it's so funny.
So those are just a short list of things that you must be doing credibly and from your heart as well as your head.
But I've talked to enough of these employees to know that he was doing every single one of those things. In fact, Joe Schmidt, who was in us with
27
in
years
in the studio, told me the other day, and this is a big deal, that he was able he was making a decent enough salary that his wife could stay at home and take care of the kids, and that's a very unusual thing today. Lots of people can't afford to do this. But you know what, Nancy, I'm hoping for some miracle here, but I almost think it is going to be a miracle. I mean, Demoulas is losing, you know,
at least $10 million
a day.
Estimates, right?
Yes, and Arthur T, the Arthur that everyone loves, has this bid in to buy the company. The board is considering it. Can there possibly be that miracle here?
So a couple of comments on this. I think that's the only way it will end in some kind of buyout, right? I think it's most likely that if there is going to be a private buyout and the company doesn't run itself into the ground, it'll probably be Arthur T. We don't know what he'll pay. The business is private, so it's hard to get really good numbers, but sales are somewhere between north of $3 billion and somewhere below $4.6 billion a year. That's a nice business. I think the single viable solution is a buyout by Arthur T. Demoulas. The board met last night. Nothing happened. They did say they would not reinstate him, right, and move away the two co-CEOs to give him back the scepter and the crown imperial. I think there's another aspect of this, though. You're Arthur T. Demoulas, right? You obviously love this business. It's part of your blood, right? It's also part of the toxicity in your family, right? It's got family drama associated with it every which way. But, you know, as John Davis, my colleague, who's a specialist in family business at HBS, said, and I believe a Globe article, he said, you know, the thing is being run into the ground as this happens. So, you know, businesses aren't just profit and loss statements. They're not just, you know, balance sheets. They are living, breathing, dynamic entities. And you let a business, right, you know, lose access to its supply chain, alienate itself from its customers. And this goes on for, you know, for much longer. It's not clear what you're going to resuscitate and how well it's going to be. So you're Arthur T. DeMullis and you're sitting home and you're thinking, how long am I willing to let the baby stay underneath the water? Right? Because he could save the child by saying, come back to work and let's get this thing moving. Right, because I love the business, but he's not doing that. Which
I mean,
is really,
saying to the people who are not working,
I love DeMullis,
but I don't
right?
want you to
I'm not
you
running.
Risk
I don't
own,
want you yeah. to risk the business. I promise you, we'll figure out how to get this thing going. And yet, he isn't doing that, which is just really interesting. I'm not saying he doesn't have good reasons for it, but you are every single day that you are that this goes on, you are damaging the child. That is, if you will, for lots of founders or lots of families that own businesses that the businesses run. Represent.
And let me be clear. You're saying to say, let's go back to work and work this out, and I will take myself out of the equation.
Not necessarily. No. You're saying go back to work so we don't ruin what we love so well,
okay.
The culture,
okay.
The brand. We haven't mentioned that word. The brand, the customer loyalty that we have here at DeMullis is this very special thing. And let's keep this baby alive while we figure out a good way to send it on to the next grade of school.
Kaitai, I only have 10 seconds left. I am always the cup half empty kind of guy. In this case, I'm the cup half full. I think he gets the company back. I think the workers go back, and ultimately their business increases over what
maybe,
it ever was.
Power to the people.
Exactly. Nicely put, Nancy Kane.
Well,
thank
also,
you.
When you go to one, you see all the bargains. You think, gee, well, I haven't been shopping here for years. Anyway, Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great to see you. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Juliet Kayyem. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, our engineer, John Parker, and our intern extraordinaire, Devin Karambulis. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browning. Don't forget, tomorrow, the guys who wrote the Market Basket
yes!
Workers Anthem will be
in
studio with us.
Absolutely. It's going to be really fun. Thanks for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow.